quietly, on the floor, and plays with them while I work. When I am finished, we take a picnic lunch down to the beach. If it's too foggy, we play indoors. Either beauty parlour, brushing each other's hair until it crackles, or Dead Bride. Dead Bride is not a complicated game like Snakes and Ladders. It's quite simple. The bride veils herself in a lace curtain and stuffs herself into the laundry hamper, where she lies as though dead while the anguished bridegroom hunts for her. When he finally discovers her entombed in the laundry hamper, he breaks into loud wails. Then, and only then, does the bride jump up, yell, "Surprise!" and clutch him to her. Then it is all joy and smiles and kisses. Privately, I don't give that marriage much of a chance. I knew that all children were gruesome, but I don't know whether I'm supposed to encourage them in it. I'm afraid to ask Sophie if Dead Bride is too morbid a game for a 4-year-old. If she says yes, we'll have to stop playing. And I don't want to stop. I love Dead Bride. So many questions arise when you are spending your days with a child. For instance, if one likes to cross one's eyes a lot, might they get stuck that way forever? Or is that a rumour? My mother said they would, and I believed her. But Kit is made of sterner stuff and doubts it. I am trying hard to remember my parents' ideas about child raising, but as the child raised, I'm scarcely a good judge. I know I got spanked for spitting my peas across the table at Mrs. Morris, but that's all I can recall. Perhaps she deserved it. Kit seems to show no ill effects from having been brought up piecemeal by society members. It certainly hasn't made her fearful and retiring. I asked Amelia about it yesterday. She smiled and said there was no hope that a child of Elizabeth's would be fearful and retiring. Then she told me a lovely story about her son, Ian, and Elizabeth when they were children. He was to be sent to school in England, and he was not at all happy about it, so he decided to run away from home. He consulted Jane and Elizabeth, and Elizabeth persuaded him to buy her boat for his escape. The trouble was, she had no boat. But she didn't tell him that. Instead, she built one herself in 3 days. On the appointed afternoon, they hauled it down to the beach, and Ian set off, with Elizabeth and Jane waving their hankies from the shore. About 1/2 mile out, the boat began to sink, fast. Jane was all for running to get her father, but Elizabeth said there wasn't time, and since it was all her fault, she would have to save him. She took off her shoes, dove into the waves, and swam out to Ian. Together, they pulled the wreckage to shore, and she brought the boy to Sir Ambrose's house to dry off. She returned his money, and as they sat steaming before the fire, she turned to him and said gloomily, "We'll just have to steal a boat, that's all." Ian told his mother that he decided it would be simpler to go to school after all. I know it will take a prodigious amount of time to catch up on your work. If you do have a moment to spare, could you find a book of paper dolls for me? One full of glamorous evening gowns, please. I know Kit is growing fond of me. She pats my knee in passing. Love, Juliet. From Juliet to Sydney, 10th of June, 1946. Dear Sydney, I've just received a wonderful package from your new secretary. Is her name really Billy B. Jones? Never mind, she's a genius anyway. She found Kit 2 books of paper dolls, and not just any old paper dolls either. She found Greta Garbo and Gone with the Wind paper dolls. Pages of lovely gowns, furs, hats, boas. Oh, they are wonderful. Billy B also sent a pair of snub-nosed scissors, a piece of thoughtfulness that would never have occurred to me. Kit is using them now. This is not a letter, but a thank you note. I'm writing one to Billy B too. However did you find such an efficient person? I hope she's plump and motherly, because that's how I'm imagining her. She enclosed a note saying eyes do not stay crossed permanently. It's an old wives' tale. Kit is thrilled and plans to cross her eyes until supper. Love to you, Juliet. P.S. I would like to point out that contrary to certain insinuating remarks in your last, Mr. Dawsey Adams makes no appearance in this letter. I haven't seen Mr. Dawsey Adams since Friday afternoon when he came to pick up Kit. He found us decked in our finest jewels and marching about the room to the stirring strains of pomp and circumstance on the gramophone. Kit made him a dish-towel cape, and he marched with us. I think he has an aristocrat lurking in his genealogy. He can gaze benevolently into the middle distance, just like a duke.
Letter received in Guernsey on the 12th of June, 1946.
To Eben or Isola or any member of a book society on Guernsey, Channel Islands, Great Britain.
Delivered to Eben, 14th of June, 1946.
Dear Guernsey Book Society, I greet you as those dear to my friend Elizabeth McKenna. I write to you now so that I may tell you of her death in Ravensbrück concentration camp. She was executed there in March of 1945. In those days before the Russian army arrived to free the camp, the SS carried truckloads of papers to the crematorium and burned them in the furnaces there. Thus, I feared you might never learn of Elizabeth's imprisonment and death. Elizabeth spoke often to me of Amelia, Isola, Dorsey, Eben, and Booker. I recall no surnames, but believe the names Eben and Isola to be unusual Christian names, and thus hope you may be found easily on Guernsey. I know also that she cherished you as her family, and she felt gratitude and peace that her daughter, Kit, was in your care. Therefore, I write so you and the child will know of her, and the strength she showed to us in the camp. Not strength only, but a métier she had for making us forget where we were for a small while. Elizabeth was my friend, and in that place, friendship was all that aided one to remain human. I reside now at the Hospice La Forêt in Louviers, in Normandy. My English is yet poor, so Sister Touvier is improving my sentences as she writes them down. I am now 24 years of age. In 1944, I was caught by the Gestapo at Blois in Brittany, with a packet of forged ration cards. I was questioned, beaten only, and sent to Ravensbrück concentration camp. I was put in Block 11, and it was here I met Elizabeth. I will tell you how we met. One evening she came to me and said my name, Remy. I had a joy to hear my name spoken. She said, "Come with me. I have a wonderful surprise to show you." I did not understand her meaning, but I ran with her to the back of the barracks. A broken window there was stuffed with papers, and she pulled them out. We climbed out and ran toward the Lagerstrasse. There I saw fully what she had meant by a wonderful surprise. The sky, showing above the walls, looked to be on fire. Low-flying clouds of red and purple, lit from below with dark gold. They changed shapes and shades as they raced together across the sky. We stood there, hand in hand, until the darkness came. I do not think that anyone outside such a place could know how much that meant to me, to spend such a quiet moment together. Our home, Block 11, held almost 400 women. In front of each barracks was a cinder path, where roll call was held twice a day, at 5:30 a.m. and in the evening after work. The women from each barrack stood in squares of 100 women each, 10 women in 10 rows. The squares would stretch so far to the right and left of ours, we could often not see the end of them in the fog. Our beds were on wooden shelves, built in platforms of three. There were pallets of straw to sleep upon, sour, smelling, and alive with fleas and lice. There were large yellow rats which ran over our feet at night. This was a good thing, for the overseers hated the rats and stench, so we would have freedom from them in the late nights. Then, Elizabeth told me about your island of Guernsey and your book society. These things seemed like heaven to me. In the bunks, the air we breathed was weighted with sickness and filth. But when Elizabeth spoke, I could imagine the good, fresh sea air and the smell of fruit in the hot sun. Though it cannot be true, I do not remember the sun shining one day on Ravensbrück. I loved to hear, too, about how your book society came to be. I almost laughed when she told of the roasted pig, but I didn't. Laughter made trouble in the barracks. There were several standpipes with cold water for us to wash in. Once a week we were taken for showers and given a piece of soap. This was necessary for us, for the thing we feared most was to be dirty, to fester. We dared not become ill, for then we could not work. We would be of no further use to the Germans, and they would have us put to death. Elizabeth and I walked with our group each morning at 6 o'clock to reach the Siemens factory where we worked. It was outside the walls of the prison. Once there we pushed handcarts to the railroad siding and unloaded heavy metal plates onto the carts. We were given wheat paste and peas at noon and returned to camp for roll call at 6 p.m. and a supper of turnip soup. Our duties changed according to need, and one day we were ordered to dig a trench to store potatoes in for winter. Our friend Alina stole a potato but dropped it on the ground. All digging stopped until the overseer could discover the thief. Alina had ulcerated corneas, and it was necessary that the overseers not notice this, for they might think her to be going blind. Elizabeth said quickly she had taken the potato, and was sent to the punishment bunker for 1 week. The cells in this bunker were very small. One day while Elizabeth was there, a guard opened the door to each cell and turned high-pressure water hoses on the prisoners. The force of the water pushed Elizabeth to the floor, but she was fortunate that the water never reached her folded blanket. She was eventually able to rise and lie under her blanket until the shivering stopped. But a young pregnant girl in the next cell was not so fortunate or so strong as to get up. She died that night, frozen to the floor. I am perhaps saying too much, things you do not wish to hear, but I must do this to tell you how Elizabeth lived, and how she held on hard to her kindness and her courage. I would like her daughter to know this also. Now I must tell you the cause of her death. Often, within months of being in camp, most women stopped menstruation, but some did not. The camp doctors had made no provision for the prisoners' hygiene during this time. No rags, no sanitary towels, no soap. The women who were menstruating just had to let the blood run down their legs. The overseers liked this, oh, so unsightly blood. It gave them the excuse to scream, to hit. A woman named Binta was the overseer for our evening roll call, and she began to rage at a bleeding girl. Rage at her, and threaten her with her upraised rod. Then she began to beat the girl. Elizabeth broke out of our line fast, so fast. She grabbed the rod from Binta's hand and turned it upon her, hitting her over and over. Guards came running, and two of them struck Elizabeth to the ground with their rifles. They threw her into a truck and took her again to the punishment bunker. One of the guards told me that on the next morning, soldiers formed a guard around Elizabeth and took her from her cell. Outside the camp walls, there was a grove of poplar trees. The branches of the trees formed an allée, and Elizabeth walked down this by herself, unaided. She knelt on the ground, and they shot her in the back of her head. I will stop now. I know that I often felt my friend beside me when I was ill after the camp. I had fevers, and I imagined that Elizabeth and I were sailing to Guernsey in a little boat. We had planned this in Ravensbrück, how we would live together in her cottage with her baby, Kit. It helped me to sleep. I hope you will come to feel Elizabeth by your side as I do. Her strength did not fail her, nor her mind, not ever. She just saw one cruelty too many. Please accept my best wishes. Rémy Giraud.
Note from Sister Cécile Touvier, placed in the envelope with Rémy's letter. Sister Cécile Touvier, nurse, writing to you. I have made Rémy go to rest now. I do not approve of this long letter, but she insisted on writing it. She will not tell you how sick she has been, but I will. In a few days before the Russians arrived at Ravensbrück, those filthy Nazis ordered anyone who could walk to leave, opened the gates and turned them loose upon the devastated countryside. Go, they ordered. Go, find any Allied troops that you can. They left those exhausted, starving women to walk miles and miles without any food or water. There were not even any gleanings left in the fields they walked past. Was it any wonder their walk became a death march? Hundreds of the women died on the road. After several days, Rémy's legs and body were so swollen with famine edema, she could not continue to walk. So she just laid herself down in the road to die. Fortunately, a company of American soldiers found her. They tried to give her something to eat, but her body would not receive it. They carried her to a field hospital, where she was given a bed, and quarts of water were drained from her body. After many months in hospital, she was well enough to be sent to this hospice in Louvigny. I will tell you she weighed less than 60 pounds when she arrived here. Otherwise she would have written you sooner. It is my belief that she will get her strength back properly once she has written this letter, and she can set about laying her friend to rest. You may, of course, write to her, but please do not ask her questions about Ravensbrück. It will be best for her to forget. Yours truly, Sister Cécile Touvier.
From Amelia to Rémy Giraud. 16th of June, 1946. Mademoiselle Rémy Giraud, Hospice La Forêt, Louvier, France. Dear Mademoiselle Giraud, how good you were to write to us. How good and how kind. It could not have been an easy task to call up your own terrible memories in order to tell us of Elizabeth's death. We had been praying that she would return to us. But it is better to know the truth than to live in uncertainty. We were grateful to learn of your friendship with Elizabeth and to think of the comfort you gave to one another. May Dorsey Adams and I come visit you in Louvier? We would like to very much, but not if you would find our visit too disturbing. We want to know you, and we have an idea to propose. But again, if you'd prefer that we didn't, we will not come. Always our blessings for your kindness and courage. Sincerely, Amelia Morgery.
From Juliet to Sydney. 16th of June, 1946. Dear Sydney, how comforting it was to hear you say, God damn, oh God damn. That's the only honest thing to say, isn't it? Elizabeth's death is an abomination, and it will never be anything else. It's odd, I suppose, to mourn so for someone you've never met. But I do. I have felt Elizabeth's presence all along. She lingers in every room I enter, not just in the cottage, but in Amelia's library, which she stocked with books, and Isola's kitchen, where she stirred up potions. Everyone always speaks of her, even now, in the present tense, and I had convinced myself that she would return. I wanted so much to know her. It's worse for everyone else. When I saw Eben yesterday, he seemed older than ever before. I'm glad he has Eli by him. Isola has disappeared. Amelia says not to worry. She does that when she's sick at heart. Dorsey and Amelia have decided to go to Louvier to try to persuade Mademoiselle Giraud to come to Guernsey. There was a heart-rending moment in her letter. Elizabeth used to help her go to sleep in the camp by planning their future in Guernsey. She said it sounded like heaven. The poor girl is due for some heaven. She has already been through hell. I am to take care of Kit while they are gone. I am so sad for her. She will never know her mother, except by hearsay. I wonder about her future, too, as she is now, officially, an orphan. Mr. Dilwyn told me there is plenty of time to make a decision. Let us leave well enough alone at the moment. He doesn't sound like any other banker or trustee I've ever heard of. Bless his heart. All my love, Juliet. From Juliet to Mark, 17th of June, 1946. Dear Mark, I'm sorry that our conversation ended badly last night. It's very difficult to convey shades of meaning while roaring into the telephone. It's true. I don't want you to come this weekend. But it has nothing whatever to do with you. My friends have just been dealt a terrible blow. Elizabeth was the centre of the circle here, and the news of her death has shaken us all. How strange. When I picture you reading that sentence, I see you wondering why this woman's death has anything to do with me, or you, or your plans for the weekend. It does. I feel as though I'd lost someone very close to me. I am in mourning. Do you understand a little better now? Yours, Juliet.
From Darcy to Juliet, 21st of June, 1946. Miss Juliet Ashton, Grand Manoir Cottage, La Bouvet, St. Martin's, Guernsey. Dear Juliet, we are here in Louvier, though we have not been to see Remy yet. The trip has tired Amelia very much, and she wants to rest for a night before we go to the hospice. It was a direful journey across Normandy. Piles of blasted stone walls and twisted metal lined the roads and towns. There are big gaps between buildings, and the ones left look like black, broken-off teeth. Whole fronts of houses are gone, and you can see in to the flowered wallpaper and the tilted bedsteads clinging somehow to the floors. I know now how fortunate Guernsey really was in the war. Many people are still in the streets, hauling away bricks and stone in wheelbarrows and carts. They've made roads of heavy wire netting placed over rubble, and tractors are moving along them. Outside the towns are ruined fields with huge craters and torn-up land and hedges. It is grievous to see the trees. No big poplars, elms, and chestnuts. What's left is pitiful, charred black and stunted. Sticks without shade. Mr. Piaget, the innkeeper here, told us that the German engineers ordered hundreds of soldiers to chop down trees, whole woods and coppices. Then they stripped off the branches, smeared the trunks with creosote, and stuck them upright in holes they had dug in the fields. The trees were called Rommel's asparagus, and were meant to keep Allied gliders from landing and soldiers from parachuting. Amelia went to bed right after supper, so I walked through Louvier. The town is pretty in spots, though much of it was bombed and the Germans set fire to it when they retreated. I cannot see how it will become a living town again. I came back and sat on the terrace till full dark, thinking about tomorrow. Give Kit a hug from me. Yours ever, Dawsey.
From Amelia to Juliet, 23rd of June, 1946. Dear Juliet, we met Remy yesterday. I felt unequal somehow to meeting her, but not, thank heavens, Dorsey. He calmly pulled up lawn chairs, sat us down under a shade tree, and asked a nurse if we could have tea. I wanted Remy to like us, to feel safe with us. I wanted to learn more about Elizabeth, but I was frightened of Remy's fragility and Sister Touvier's admonitions. Remy is very small and is far too thin. Her dark curly hair is cut close to her head and her eyes are enormous and haunted. You can see that she was a beauty in better times, but now she's like glass. Her hands tremble a good deal, and she is careful to hold them down in her lap. She welcomed us as much as she was able, but she was very reserved, until she asked about Kit. Had she gone on to Sir Ambrose in London? Dorsey told her of Sir Ambrose's death and how we are raising Kit. He showed her the photograph of you and Kit that he carries. She smiled then and said, "She is Elizabeth's child. Is she strong?" I couldn't speak, thinking of our lost Elizabeth, but Dorsey said, "Yes, very strong," and told her about Kit's passion for ferrets. That made her smile again. Remy is alone in the world. Her father died long before the war. In 1943, her mother was sent to Drancy for harbouring enemies of the government, and later died in Auschwitz. Remy's two brothers are missing. She thought she saw one of them in a German train station as she was on her way to Ravensbrück, but he didn't turn when she screamed his name. The other she has not seen since 1941. She believes that they, too, must be dead. I was glad Dorsey had the courage to ask her questions. Remy seemed to find relief in speaking of her family. I finally broached the subject of Remy coming to stay a while with me in Guernsey. She grew reserved again and explained that she was going to leave the hospice very soon. The French government is offering pensions to concentration camp survivors, for time lost in camps, for permanent injuries, and for recognition of suffering. They also give a small stipend to those who wish to resume their education. In addition to the government stipend, the association National des Anciens Déportés et Internés de la Résistance will help Remy pay the rent of a room or share a flat with other survivors, so she has decided to go to Paris and seek an apprenticeship in a bakery. She was adamant about her plans, so I left the matter there. But I don't believe Dorsey is willing to do so. He thinks that sheltering Remy is a moral debt we owe to Elizabeth. Perhaps he's right. Or perhaps it is simply a way to relieve our sense of helplessness. In any case, he has arranged to go back tomorrow and take Remy for a walk along the canal and to visit a certain pâtisserie he saw in Louviers. Sometimes I wonder where our old shy Dorsey has gone. I feel well, though I am unusually tired. Perhaps it is seeing my beloved Normandy so devastated. I will be glad to be home, my dear. A kiss for you and Kit. Amelia.
From Juliet to Sydney, 28th of June, 1946. Dear Sydney, what an inspired present you sent Kit. Red satin tap shoes covered with sequins. Wherever did you find them? Where are mine? Amelia has been tired since her return from France, so it seems best for Kit to stay with me, especially if Remy decides to come to Amelia's when she leaves the hospice. Kit seems to like the idea too, heaven be thanked. Kit knows her mother is dead now, Dorsey told her. I'm not sure what she feels about it. She hasn't said anything, and I wouldn't dream of pressing her. I try not to hover unduly or make her special treats. After Mother and Father died, Mr. Simplice's cook brought me huge slices of cake and then stood there, watching me mournfully while I tried to swallow. I hated her for thinking that cake would somehow make it up to me for losing my parents. Of course, I was a wretched 12-year-old, and Kitty's only 4. She would probably like some extra cake. But you understand what I mean. Sydney, I am in trouble with my book. I have much of the data from the States' records and a slew of personal interviews to start the story of the occupation, but I can't make them come together in a structure that pleases me. Straight chronology is too tedious. Shall I pack my pages up and send them to you? They need a finer and more impersonal eye than mine. Would you have time to look them over now, or is the backlog from your Australian trip still so heavy? If it is, don't worry. I am working anyway, and something brilliant may yet come to me. Love, Juliet. P.S. Thank you for the lovely clipping of Mark dancing with Ursula Fent. If you were hoping to send me into a jealous rage, you failed. Especially as Mark had already telephoned to tell me that Ursula follows him about like a lovesick bloodhound. You see? The two of you do have something in common. You both want me to be miserable. Perhaps you could start a club.
From Sydney to Juliet. 1st of July, 1946. Dear Juliet, don't pack up your pages. I want to come to Guernsey myself. Will this weekend suit you? I want to see you, Kit, and Guernsey in that order. I have no intention of reading your pages while you pace up and down in front of me. I'll bring the manuscript back to London. I can arrive Friday afternoon on the 5 o'clock plane and stay until Monday evening. Will you book a hotel room for me? Can you also manage a small supper party? I want to meet Eben, Isola, Dawsey, and Amelia. I'll bring the wine. Love, Sydney.
From Juliet to Sydney. Wednesday. Dear Sydney, wonderful. Isola won't hear of you staying at the inn. She hints of bedbugs. She wants to put you up herself and needs to know if noises at dawn are apt to bother you. That is when Ariel, her goat, arises. Zenobia the parrot is a late sleeper. Dawsey and I and his cart will meet you at the airfield. May Friday hurry up and get here. Love, Juliet.
From Isola to Juliet, left under Juliet's door. Friday, close to dawn. Lovey, I can't stop. I must hurry to my market stall. I am glad your friend will be staying with me. I've put lavender sprigs in his sheets. Is there one of my elixirs you'd like me to slip in his coffee? Just nod to me at market, and I'll know which one you mean. Kisses, Isola.
From Sydney to Sophie. 6th of July, 1946. Dear Sophie, I am at last on Guernsey with Juliet, and am ready to tell you 3 or 4 of the dozen things you asked me to find out. First and foremost, Kit seems as fond of Juliet as you and I are. She is a spirited little thing, affectionate in a reserved way, which is not as contradictory as it sounds, and quick to smile when she is with one of her adoptive parents from the Literary Society. She is adorable, too, with round cheeks, round curls, and round eyes. The temptation to cuddle her is nearly overwhelming, but it would be a slight upon her dignity, and I am not brave enough to try it. When she sees someone she doesn't like, she has a stare that would shrivel Medea. Isola says she reserves it for cruel Mr. Smythe, who beats his dog, and evil Mrs. Gilbert, who called Juliet a nosy Parker and told her she ought to go back to London where she belonged. I'll tell you one story of Kit and Juliet together. Dawsey, more about him later, came by to pick Kit up and go see Eben's fishing boat come in. Kit said goodbye, flew out, then flew back in, ran up to Juliet, lifted her skirt 1/4 inch, kissed her kneecap, and flew back out again. Juliet looked dumbfounded, and then as happy as you or I have ever seen her. I know you think Juliet seemed tired, worn, frazzled, and pale when you saw her last winter. I don't think you realize how harrowing those teas and interviews can be. She looks as healthy as a horse now, and is full of her old zest. So full, Sophie, I think she may never want to live in London again, though she doesn't realize it yet. Sea air, sunshine, green fields, wild flowers, the ever-changing sky and ocean, and most of all, the people seem to have seduced her from city life. I can easily see how they could. It's such a homey, welcoming place. Isola is the kind of hostess you always wished you'd come across on a country visit, but never do. She rousted me out of bed the first morning to help her dry rose petals, churn butter, stir up something, God knows what, in a big pot, feed Ariel, and go to the fish market to buy her an eel. All of this with Zenobia, the parrot, on my shoulder. Now, about Dorsey Adams. I have inspected him, as per instructions. I liked what I saw. He's quiet, capable, trustworthy. Oh, Lord, I've made him sound like a dog. And he has a sense of humour. In short, he is completely unlike any of Juliet's other swains. Praise indeed. He did not say much at our first meeting, nor at any of our meetings since, come to think of it. But let him walk into a room, and everyone in it seems to breathe a little sigh of relief. I have never in my life had that effect on anyone. Can't imagine why not. Juliet seems a bit nervous around him. His silence is slightly daunting, and she made a dreadful mess of the tea things when he came by for Kit yesterday. But Juliet has always shattered teacups. Remember what she did to Mother's spode? So that may not signify. As for him, he watches her with dark, steady eyes until she looks at him, and then he glances away. I do hope you're appreciating my observational skills. One thing I can say unequivocally, he's worth dozens of Mark Reynolds's. I know you think I'm unreasonable about Reynolds, but you haven't met him. He's all charm and oil, and he gets what he wants. It's one of his few principles. He wants Juliet because she's pretty and intellectual at the same time, and he thinks they'll make an impressive couple. If she marries him, she'll spend the rest of her life being shown to people at theatres and clubs and weekends, and she'll never write another book. As her editor, I'm dismayed by that prospect. But as a friend, I'm horrified. It will be the end of our Juliet. It's hard to say what Juliet is thinking about Reynolds, if anything. I asked her if she missed him, and she said, "Mark? I suppose so." As if he were a distant uncle and not a favourite one at that. I'd be delighted if she forgot all about him, but I don't think he'll allow it. To return to minor topics like the occupation and Juliet's book, I was invited to accompany her on calls to several islanders this afternoon. Her interviews were to be about Guernsey's Day of Liberation on May 9th last year. What a morning that must have been. The crowds were lined up along St. Peter Port's Harbour. Silent, absolutely silent, masses of people looking at the Royal Navy ships sitting just outside their harbour. Then, when the Tommies landed and marched ashore, all hell broke loose. Hugs, kisses, crying, yelling. So many of the soldiers landing were Guernseymen themselves. Men who hadn't seen or heard a word from their families in 5 years. You can imagine their eyes searching the crowds for family members as they marched, and the joy of their reunions. Mr. Lebrun, a retired postman, told us the most unusual story of all. Some British ships took leave of the fleet in St. Peter Port, and sailed a few miles north to St. Sampson's Harbour. Crowds had gathered there, waiting to see the landing craft crash through the German anti-tank barriers and come up onto the beach. When the bay doors opened, out came not a platoon of uniformed soldiers, but one lone man, got up as a caricature English gent in striped trousers, a morning coat, top hat, furled umbrella, and a copy of yesterday's Times clasped in his hand. There was a split second of silence before the joke sank in, and then the crowd roared. He was mobbed, clapped on the back, kissed, and put up on the shoulders of four men to be marched down the street. Someone screamed, "News! News from London herself!" and snatched the Times out of his hand. Whoever that soldier was, he was brilliant and deserves a medal. When the rest of the soldiers emerged, they were carrying chocolates, oranges, cigarettes, tea bags to toss to the crowd. Brigadier Snow announced that the cable to England was being repaired, and soon they could be talking to their evacuated children and families in England. The ships also brought in food, tons of it, and medicines, paraffin, animal feed, clothes, cloth, seeds, and shoes. There must be enough stories to fill three books. It may be a matter of culling. But don't worry if Juliet sounds nervous from time to time. She should. It's a daunting task. I must stop now and get dressed for Juliet's supper party. Isola is swathed in three shawls and a lace dresser scarf, and I want to do her proud. Love to you all. Sydney.
From Juliet to Sophie, 7th of July, 1946. Dear Sophie, just a note to tell you, Sydney is here, and we can stop worrying about him and his leg. He looks wonderful. Tanned, fit, and without a noticeable limp. In fact, we threw his cane in the ocean. I'm sure it's halfway to France by now. I had a small supper party for him, cooked by me alone, and edible too. Will Thisbe gave me the Beginner's Cookbook for Girl Guides. It was just the thing. The writer assumes you know nothing about cookery and writes useful hints. When adding eggs, break the shells first. Sydney is having a grand time as Isola's house guest. They apparently sat up late talking last night. Isola doesn't approve of small talk and believes in breaking the ice by stomping on it. She asked him if we were engaged to be married. If not, why not? It was plain to everyone that we doted on one another. Sydney told her that indeed he did dote on me. Always had, always would. But we both realized we could never marry. He was a homosexual. Sydney told me that Isola neither gasped, fainted, nor blinked. Just gave him her good old fisheye and asked, "And Juliet knows?" When he told her yes, I had always known, Isola jumped up, swooped down, kissed his forehead, and said, "How nice, just like dear Booker. I'll not tell a soul, you can rely on me." Then she sat back down and began to talk about Oscar Wilde's plays. Weren't they a stitch? Sophie, wouldn't you have loved to be a fly on the wall? I would. Sydney and I are going shopping now for a hostess gift for Isola. I said she would love a warm, colourful shawl, but he wants to get her a cuckoo clock. Why? Love, Juliet. P.S. Mark doesn't write. He telephones. He rang me up just last week. It was one of those terrible connections that forced us perpetually to interrupt one another and bellow, "What?" But I managed to get the gist of the conversation. I should come home and marry him. I politely disagreed. It upset me much less than it would have a month ago.
From Isola to Sydney, 8th of July, 1946. Dear Sydney, you are a very nice house guest. I like you. So did Zenobia, else she would not have flown onto your shoulder and cuddled there so long. I'm glad you like to sit up late and talk. I favour that myself of an evening. I am going to go to the manor now to find the book you told me about. How is it that Juliet and Amelia never made mention of Miss Jane Austen to me? I hope you will come visit Guernsey again. Did you like Juliet's soup? Wasn't it tasty? She will be ready for pie crust and gravy soon. You must go with cooking slowly, else you'll just make slops. I was lonesome for company after you left, So I invited Dawsey and Amelia to take tea yesterday. You should have seen how I didn't utter a word when Amelia said she thought you and Juliet were going to marry. I even nodded and slitted my eyes, like I knew something they didn't, to throw them off the scent. I do like my cuckoo clock. How cheery it is! I run in the kitchen to watch it. I am sorry Zenobia bit the little bird's head off. She has a jealous nature. But Eli said he could carve me another one as good as new. His little perch still pops out on the hour. With fondness, your hostess, Isola Pribby.
From Juliet to Sydney, 9th of July, 1946. Dear Sydney, I knew it. I knew you'd love Guernsey. The next best thing to being here myself was having you here, even for such a short visit. I'm happy that you know all my friends now, and they you. I'm particularly happy you enjoyed Kit's company so much. I regret to tell you that some of her fondness for you is due to your present, Elspeth the Lisping Bunny. Her admiration for Elspeth has caused her to take up lisping, and I am sorry to say she is very good at it. Dawsey just brought Kit home. They have been visiting his new piglet. Kit asked if I was writing to Thidney. When I said yes, she said, "Thay, I want him to come back soon." Do you see what I mean about Elspeth? That made Dawsey smile, which pleased me. I'm afraid you didn't see the best of Dawsey this weekend. He was extra quiet at my supper party. Perhaps it was my soup, but I think it more likely that he is preoccupied with Remy. He seems to think that she won't get better until she comes to Guernsey to recuperate. I am glad you took my pages home to read. God knows I am at a loss to divine just what exactly is wrong with them. I only know something is. What on earth did you say to Isola? She stopped in on her way to pick up Pride and Prejudice and to berate me for never telling her about Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy. Why hadn't she known there were better love stories around? Stories not riddled with ill-adjusted men, anguish, death and graveyards. What else had we kept from her? I apologized for such a lapse and said you were perfectly right. Pride and Prejudice was one of the greatest love stories ever written, and she might actually die of suspense before she finished it. Isola said Zenobia is saddened by your leaving. She's off her feed. So am I, but I'm so grateful you could come at all. Love, Juliet.
From Sydney to Juliet. 12th of July, 1946. Dear Juliet, I've read your chapters several times, and you are right. They won't do. Strings of anecdotes don't make a book. Juliet, your book needs a centre. I don't mean more in-depth interviews. I mean one person's voice to tell what was happening all around her. As written now, the facts, as interesting as they are, seem like random, scattered shots. It would hurt like hell to write this letter to you, except for one thing. You already have the call. You just don't know it yet. I am talking about Elizabeth McKenna. Didn't you ever notice how everyone you interviewed, sooner or later, talked about Elizabeth? Lord, Juliet, who painted Booker's portrait and saved his life and danced down the street with him? Who thought up the lie about the Literary Society and then made it happen? Guernsey wasn't her home, but she adapted to it and to the loss of her freedom. How? She must have missed Ambrose and London, but she never, I gather, whined about it. She went to Ravensbrook for sheltering a slave worker. Look how and why she died. Juliet, how did a girl, an art student, who had never held a job in her life, turn herself into a nurse working 6 days a week in the hospital? She did have dear friends, but in reality, she had no one to call her own at first. She fell in love with an enemy officer and lost him. She had a baby alone during wartime. It must have been fearful, despite all her good friends. You can only share responsibilities up to a point. I'm sending back the manuscript and your letters to me. Read them again, and see how often Elizabeth is spoken of. Ask yourself, why? Talk to Dorsey and Eben. Talk to Isola and Amelia. Talk to Mr. Dilwyn and to anyone else who knew her well. You live in her house. Look around you, at her books, her belongings. I think you should write your book around Elizabeth. I think Kit would greatly value a story about her mother. It would give her something to hang on to later. So, either quit altogether, or get to know Elizabeth well. Think long and hard, and tell me if Elizabeth could be the heart of your book. Love to you and Kit. Sydney.
From Juliet to Sydney, 15th of July, 1946. Dear Sydney, I don't need more time to think about it. The minute I read your letter, I knew you were right. So slow-witted. Here I've been, wishing that I had known Elizabeth, missing her as if I had. Why did I never once think of writing about her? I'll begin tomorrow. I want to talk to Dorsey, Amelia, Eben and Isola first. I feel that she belongs to them more than the others, and I want their blessing. Remy wants to come to Guernsey after all. Dorsey has been writing to her, and I knew he could persuade her to come. He could talk an angel out of heaven if he chose to speak, which is not often enough to suit me. Remy will stay with Amelia, so I get to keep Kit with me. Undying love and gratitude, Juliet. P.S. You don't suppose Elizabeth kept a diary, do you? From Juliet to Sydney, 17th of July, 1946. Dear Sydney, no diary, but the good news is she did draw while her paper and pencil lasted. I found some sketches stuffed into a large art folio on the bottom shelf of the sitting room bookcase. Quick line drawings that seem marvellous portraits to me. Isola caught unaware, hitting at something with a wooden spoon. Dorsey digging in a garden. Eben and Amelia with their heads together, talking. As I sat on the floor, turning them over, Amelia dropped by for a visit. Together, we pulled out several large sheets of paper, covered with sketch after sketch of Kit. Kit asleep, Kit on the move, on a lap, being rocked by Amelia, hypnotized by her toes, delighted with her spit bubbles. Maybe every mother looks at her baby that way, with that intense focus. But Elizabeth put it on paper. There was one shaky drawing of a wizened little Kit, made the day after she was born, according to Amelia. Then I found a sketch of a man with a good, strong, rather broad face. He's relaxed and appears to be looking over his shoulder, smiling at the artist. I knew at once it was Christian. He and Kit have a cowlick in exactly the same place. Amelia took the paper into her hands. I had never heard her speak of him before, and asked if she had liked him. "Poor boy," she said. I was so set against him. It seemed insane to me that Elizabeth had chosen him, an enemy, a German. And I was frightened for her. For the rest of us, too. I thought that she was too trusting, and he would betray her and us. So I told her that I thought she should break it off with him. I was very stern with her. Elizabeth just stuck out her chin and said nothing. But the next day, he came to visit me. Oh, I was appalled. I opened the door, and there was an enormous, uniformed German standing before me. I was sure my house was about to be requisitioned, and I began to protest when he thrust forward a bunch of flowers, limp from being clutched. I noticed he was looking very nervous, so I stopped scolding and demanded to know his name. "Captain Christian Hellman," he said, and blushed like a boy. I was still suspicious. What was he up to? And asked him the purpose of his visit. He blushed more and said softly, "I've come to tell you my intentions." "For my house?" I snapped. "No, for Elizabeth," he said. And that's what he did. just as if I were the Victorian father and he the suitor. He perched on the edge of a chair in my drawing room and told me that he intended to come back to the island the moment the war was over, marry Elizabeth, raise Freesias, read, and forget about war. By the time he was finished speaking, I was a little in love with him myself. Amelia was half in tears, so we put the sketches away, and I made her some tea. Then Kit came in with a shattered gull's egg she wanted to glue together, and we were thankfully distracted. Yesterday, Will Thisby appeared at my door with a plate of cakes iced with prune whip, so I invited him to tea. He wanted to consult with me about two different women, and which one of the two I'd marry if I were a man, which I wasn't. Do you have that straight? Miss X has always been a ditherer. She was a 10-month baby and has not improved in any material way since then. When she heard the Germans were coming, she buried her mother's silver teapot under an elm tree and now can't remember which tree. She is digging holes all over the island, vowing she won't stop till she finds it. Such determination, said Will. Quite unlike her. Will was trying to be subtle, but Miss X is Daphne Post. She has round, vacant eyes like a cow's, and is famous for her trembling soprano in the church choir. And then there is Miss Y, a local seamstress. When the Germans arrived, they had only packed one Nazi flag. This they needed to hang over their headquarters, but that left them with nothing to run up a flagpole to remind the islanders they'd been conquered. They visited Miss Y and ordered her to make a Nazi flag for them. She did. A black, nasty swastika, stitched onto a circle of dingy puce. The surrounding field was not scarlet silk, but baby bottom pink flannel. So inventive in her spite, said Will. So forceful. Miss Y is Miss Leroy, thin as one of her needles, with a lantern jaw and tight-folded lips. Which did I think would make the best companion for a man's nether years, Miss X or Miss Y? I told him that if one had to ask which, it generally meant neither. He said, that's exactly what Dawsey said, those very words. Isola said Miss X would bore me to tears, and Miss Y would nag me to death. Thank you. Thank you. I shall keep up my search. She is out there somewhere. He put on his cap, bowed, and left. Sydney, he may have been polling the entire island, but I was so flattered to have been included. It made me feel like an islander instead of an outlander. Love, Juliet. P.S. I was interested to learn that Dawsey has opinions on marriage. I wish I knew more about them. From Juliet to Sydney, 19th of July, 1946. Dear Sydney, stories of Elizabeth are everywhere, not just among the society members. Listen to this. Kit and I walked up to the churchyard this afternoon. Kit was off playing among the tombstones, and I was stretched out on Mr. Edwin Mullis's tombstone. It's a tabletop one, with four stout legs. When Sam Withers, the cemetery's ancient groundskeeper, stopped beside me, he said I reminded him of Miss McKenna when she was a young girl. She used to take the sun right there on that very slab, brown as a walnut she'd get. I sat up straight as an arrow and asked Sam if he had known Elizabeth well. Sam said, well, not to say real well, but I liked her. She and Eben's girl Jane used to come up here together to that very tombstone. They'd spread a cloth and eat their picnic, right on top of Mr. Mullis's dead bones. Sam went on about what catbirds those two little girls were, always up to some mischief. They tried to raise a ghost one time and scared the daylights out of the vicar's wife. Then he looked over at Kit, who'd reached the church gate by then, and said, that's surely a sweet little girl of hers and Captain Hellman's. I pounced on that. Had he known Captain Hellman? Had he liked him? He glared at me and said, yes, I did. He was a fine fella, for all he was a German. You're not going to throw off on Miss McKenna's little girl because of that, are you? I wouldn't dream of it, I said. He waggled a finger at me.
You better not, Missy. You'd best learn the truth of certain matters.